Best of your honest judgment is enough. Okay, so if according to all you know and all you feel and you give it a really honest appraisal, and then your appraisal turns out to be wrong, you don't break his vow. Okay. He says, one more point, and then I'll take a few questions if you want. But I know you're hungry, and tomorrow's going to be a long day, so get ready. So what's happening to this arhat, this guy, who because of his understanding of emptiness, and because he saw all those things the moment after he came out of the direct perception of emptiness, he has finally been able, through the process we just described. I mean, if you sit there and let people cut your fingers off and don't get mad, then probably you're not going to get very mad again. And sooner or later, you'll be able to overcome anger itself. You will never get mad again. So here you have this guy called an arhat. He has reached a state called nirvana, which is a permanent destruction of his own mental afflictions because of his understanding of emptiness. Because if you keep up acting like this over a period of time, you're not going to have these mental afflictions anymore. Those sticks are going to have to move out of your house. What's the emptiness of that arhat experiencing his own mind empty of mental afflictions? You tell me, anybody, what's the dependent origination of an arhat's mind? It's also a projection. It's also a projection. Okay? He is being forced by his karmic seeds to see what? His own mind as being totally pure of mental afflictions. It's cool. It's very interesting. Of course his mind is dependently originating. Of course it's another projection. It's just one more projection. It's one more object. He is being forced by his past deeds to perceive his own mind as never again having a mental affliction. And that's the only way you can get your mind to be like that. Okay? What did you think? Someone was going to operate? You know? I mean, they were going to identify the synapses that relate to anger and cut them out of your mind? Or, you know, what did you think was going to happen? How did you think you were going to get to be an arhat? It's just another shifting of your own projections. Nothing external is happening. It's not like someone's coming and extracting mental afflictions from your head. It's not like that. You are being forced. It's like everything else in the world. It's like every other change that can ever occur in the world. It is dependently originating. You are being forced by your own karma to see an otherwise blank mind as not having any more mental affliction. It's one more projection that's being forced on you by your past deeds. The mind of an Arya, like every other mind and like every other object in the universe, is blank. It's the glass of liquid on the table between the three beings. And he, in particular, is being forced to see his mind as totally clean and permanently clean. Why? His own past deeds. His own past thoughts and words and deeds. So it's cool. Even the mind of an Arya, a mind which is totally free of all bad thoughts again, ever again, we can't wait to something in the future that will never happen, is a projection. It's a result of the same processes. Okay. And by the way, it could never have been any other way. There ain't no other way. If it were any other way, it would be gatha. Any other kind of Arya's mind don't exist anyway. And could never exist. Okay. We'll do a few questions and then we'll have a well-deserved lunch. Yeah.
How do you know that they're all gone? And just because you haven't experienced a mental affliction for a year doesn't mean that it's not going to come up next year or something like that. Can't you still have the karma to have one come up?
It's a good point. And that's why, in the definition of the eighth level, they say, Nyomong dan nyomong gi bachak sepa. Say nyomong dan nyomong gi bachak sepa. Nyomong means the mental afflictions. Nyomong gi bachak means all seeds for those mental afflictions have also been wiped out of your mind. So that's where his question, the answer comes from. I didn't give you the whole definition. I mean, the eighth level is not only removing all your mental afflictions, it is to remove permanently all the propensities for those mental afflictions. Every kind of energy in your mind that could ever trigger a mental affliction is also gone.
So how do you know that?
I guess they know it. But, by the way, it's simultaneous to the permanent ending of the habit of seeing things as self-existent. So maybe that's a clue. Maybe that's a clue. The last affliction you have to get rid of, the very last mental affliction you have to finish off, sepa, is the one that thinks, that sees things as self-existent. Okay? That's the final. And I guess when that happens, you know. I mean, that's what I'd say they know. It's called sepa shepa. The Yongsa Shepa in the Abhidhamma. It's the knowledge that you've finished it off. That you've finished off the mental afflictions and any kind of energy that could trigger them in your own mind.
Yeah. In the example, the saint has had direct perception of it. Would it be possible to act this way on the basis of an intellectual?
That's the whole point. You know, that's the whole point. He's saying, you're assuming this guy has seen emptiness directly, and probably he's close to arhat or an arhat. He's saying, what about just plain old us? You know, if all we have is an intellectual understanding from a couple of days of Dharma teaching, should we try it, or is it useless? No, that is the path. That is the path. As with bodhicitta, you have to fake it until you get the real thing. And that's a practice. Even in Tantra, many of the levels are called chuma. The first half of Tantra is called chuma. You're faking it. You're trying to imagine that something's happening when it's not happening yet. And imagining it with the right devotion makes it happen. But that's another subject. Yeah.
Would it help to think of it, would it help in not getting angry to think of, just not take it personal, not think of it someone doing something to you, but think of it truly your karma, and that person not really necessarily as a person connected to you, but...
Yeah, that's Chittembe Lam. We talked about it the other night. That is a path, but it's a worldly path. You know, just to use other methods to not get angry. They are a Buddhist path, and they are an important Buddhist path, but they are still in the world. We call them, the Abhidhamma says they are still in the world. Until you use the understanding of emptiness to stop your anger, then all those other methods are called Jigdenbe Lam. They are worldly methods of stopping, of temporarily preventing anger. I call them band-aids, okay? Band-aids are important. And they're useful, and you have to learn all the band-aids. Those are very important, and they're extremely useful, and they help you get to the real one. They're the virtue that allows you to reach the real one. But in the end, it's only understanding the emptiness of the situation. Of the guy who's getting angry, the guy who's getting angered at, and the anger itself that's going to let you stop it.
I get the karma doing the violent action to collect somebody else.
Oh, she said, do you get bad karma from doing a violent action to collect someone else? And again, I refer to the bodhisattva vows. In the bodhisattva vows, when they cover the vow about doing something forceful to help someone else, then somebody asked the question in the scripture, like based on a Sangha's root scripture, somebody comes up and says, do I collect a bad deed if with the right motivation and with the right training and with the right understanding, I do violence to a person to stop them from hurting someone else? And Jetsun Kapa says, not only do you not collect a bad deed, you collect an infinitely good deed. Mm-hmm. So you can't measure the goodness of the karma that's going to come back to you. Mm-hmm. It's a very cool answer, and he said it a couple of times.
Talk about how projection evolved from your
nest,
if
there
was,
he says, how does the process of projection change between a person who hasn't seen emptiness yet, a person who has seen emptiness directly, and then a person who's been in arhat already, for example? Are they projecting? Is the process of projection any different? No. The process is the same. It's exactly the same dhokpa, tiny dhokpa. What is the process? Your mind is collecting data. Your mind forms that data into a nice, unreal mental image whole, and then your mind calls it glass of water as opposed to glass of blood or glass of nectar. Your mind, because you've been forced by your own past karma, imputes it in a certain way. So from that point of view, the process is totally the same. Even for a Buddha, when a Buddha looks down and sees those marks on his own body, it's exactly the same process going on. What's different is the understanding of each person and the belief in the self-existence of the thing. Okay? The person who hasn't seen emptiness directly has a certain belief in the self-existence of what appears to him as self-existent. He sees it as self-existent, and he believes it's self-existent. After you see emptiness directly, you do still see it as self-existent, but you don't believe yourself. So there's a big difference. After you've reached the eighth bodhisattva level, you don't see it as self-existent, and you don't believe it's self-existent. And once you've gotten through the other two bodhisattva levels, you don't have any kind of propensity for seeing it as self-existent or believing in it as self-existent. And that's the four distinctions. Lamayashi Stupa, for example. I mean, an eighth level bodhisattva could sit and enjoy this stupa, but he understands he doesn't believe in its self-existence, and it doesn't look self-existent to him anymore either. Absolutely. The projection is the same. Well, no, you're right. By that time, the projection is... There's probably some difference in the quality of the projection.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know. I haven't studied those schools. I haven't studied that concept. In traditional Buddhism, it's called Dhammane Tattva. Dhammane means from the primeval. Primeval purity. Okay. Primeval purity. In other words, this stupa has been totally devoid of self-existence since forever. You know, things never were self-existent. And in that sense, primevally, they have been pure. Does that help you any? No. And, until you interact with it with knowledge, the fact that this object has been totally pure of self-existence since forever doesn't matter. I mean, for example, your own mind has been it's been totally pure in the sense of not being self-existent since forever. But it don't do you any good until you start to understand it. You know. Okay. Maybe two more questions and then we'll...
I'm sorry if it's not being complicated and I need emptiness in terms of understanding the karma of it.
We're going to, she says, how to, in the context of emptiness, how do the laws of karma relate? And we're going to talk about it in the final class. That's class number 10. And the point there is, Nagarjuna and Tsongkhapa spending their whole career trying to convince people that not only do emptiness and functionality get along, you know, not only is it true that karma and emptiness can coexist, they need each other. If things weren't empty, karma couldn't work. If karma weren't around, emptiness wouldn't mean anything. Okay? And that's, we have to talk about that. I call it the marriage of emptiness and ethics. Okay? I mean, they are not only not contradictory, they are intimately, they embrace each other and they can't live without each other. And that you have to study. We'll get to that in class 10. Okay? John?
Towards the end, one of the questions concerned the function of on the path of meditation, of on the path of spiritualization, of your first understanding of emptiness. Mm-hmm. The way I read it, it was talking about the first understanding of emptiness on the path of spiritualization.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. Yeah.
You didn't mean that. You meant the path of seeing understanding.
Yeah, yeah. And I meant specifically the second half. the Jacob issue, the wisdom, because that's the one that really helps a lot. And that's the one mentioned in the definition of Nirvana. Sotsotto, seeing the Four Noble Truths and their 16 aspects one by one.
Is karma infinite? Do we have, you know, and then also if that's the case, then we all have the same amount, since we all have, and I'm not sure if karma has a finite.
We'll talk about it. Well, it was empty, okay? I think you have to say this. It's important to say one thing. Abhidharma, fourth chapter, ultimate presentation of karma. Karma ripens in three stages. Okay? Karma can ripen in three different periods. The first one is called karma that you see. And that means karma that ripens before you die. Karma that ripens before you die. Karma whose results you see in this life. Okay? And the great masters of Tantra say in their beautiful books, that's how Tantra works. That's the whole idea of Tantra. Okay? That's a key to Tantra. It's definitely possible that, for example, if you have been generous in the first part of your life, that people will be rushing to give you money and property and all that other stuff as you get to your middle age. Okay? And if you practice certain secret practices extremely well, that before you die, you could actually see yourself become a tantric deity. And you would be a tantric deity. Okay? And that's the first ripening. Second kind is called karma that ripens in the very next life. And I can think of the example of the big five bad deeds. They're called the five immediate deeds. And in your next life, you always go to the lowest hell. If you kill your father, if you kill your mother, if you kill an arhat, if you try to hurt a Buddha, or if you are a Devadatta in 500 BC and split up the Sangha, which fortunately we can't do anymore. Okay? We can do a close one, but we can't do that one. If you do any one of those five, then in the very next life, you must, in the next rebirth, by the way, you must go to the lowest hell. Why did I say next rebirth and not next life? Yeah, technically the next life is your Bible. You know, technically you got one little rebirth to live before you go to your main rebirth. And you do go through that. Even if you commit one of those five, you still have to go through a Bardo. Why? That's how you get there. That's a function of a Bardo.
So even with Tantra, you still go to the lowest
hell? No. And we're going to talk about that. She asked, if you commit one of those five, and then you got into the secret teachings, could you purify them and not go to the lowest hell? Absolutely, yes. You could purify it. And that's one of the great things about that path. Okay. But the function of a bardo, if you get into it, which is also third chapter of Abhidhamma, is that you need to get to the hell. And it's that spirit body with which you travel to the hell. Okay. You need that to get there. That's why people born in the formless realm don't have a bardo. Because you enter the formless realm wherever you die. Because there's no place. There's no form. Okay. But that's a long story. One more question. Sorry. Karma which ripens in the next birth after that and beyond. Okay. Karma which ripens in the next birth after that and beyond. How big is your karmic pocket? How long can karma stay in there? What kind of karma do you got in your karmic pocket that you long since forgot doing, you know? How many karmas are you going to be stuck with that guy 3,000 lives ago did? That was you, okay, but I don't remember it at all. It doesn't seem fair that I should get stuck with all that, you know? Like, I'll take the good ones, like being in a Dharma class that he set up, but I don't want the bad ones. Okay? Yeah, the karmic pocket is quite deep. It can be millions of years long. And you must study the teachings for cutting a hole in the bottom of that pocket. And that's called the four powers. And we'll cover that. We have to cover that. You got to find a way to short-circuit those old bad karmas. Because just not collecting new bad karmas by not responding with knowledge ain't enough, because that karmic pocket is real deep. You know. Does that necessarily mean that we all have the same karmic pockets? No. We've worn out that we've all done the same bad deeds infinitely many times, and so has the Buddha. But some of us have been able to wear out certain ones and by experiencing them or by purifying them, and we don't have as big as pockets as other people or like that. It is in the scripture very definitely stated that the Buddha was sitting with us in a class like this at some point many times. Shakyamuni Buddha, good old Chikitin, was sitting with us in our classes many, many, many times. He was our classmate many, many, many times. But he just worked harder. You know, there was a day when he was exactly like you and me. And we were sitting side by side in classes, and he just worked harder. And he got out. One more question, we'll stop. There is a kind of karma called Dr. Debu. Say Dr. Debu. Dr. Debu. It's hard to translate because Dakwa means owner and De means karmic consequence. But what it means is like an environmental result. And what that means is that two or more people can collect karma together, which causes them to experience an object in common. Okay. Like all of us here on this platform today have been together in the past, certainly, and we have all collected a great virtue together. You know, we served some lama, we did some great deeds together, and the karmic result of that is that we're all here together today. Absolutely true. Must be true, because we are experiencing the same teaching today. That's a common karma. Why, when you go from South San Diego to Tijuana, and you cross this totally imaginary line, people are poor on one side and overly wealthy on the other side, you know. And the line is totally imaginary. Everybody to the north of that imaginary line has collected the same kind of karma to experience a relative state of comfort. And many people on the southern side of that line have collected together a karma to live in some kind of poverty together. And that also is in the King Udayana story. In the King Udayana story, people in that land have a very bad... they suffer together because as a people they allowed some terrible things to go on before. For example, if everyone in the United States supports the idea of abortion, you know, if we as a people support the concept of that kind of killing, which according to Buddhism is murder, and is considered a particularly, the scripture says, particularly repugnant kind of murder because the victim can't defend themselves. They have no means with which to fight back. They're too small. You know, it's like a big bully picking on a little guy. If as a culture or as a people we support that kind of activity, then as a people we will live together in a place that will have a lot of murder or a lot of violence in that country. You know, what, like, we'll be born in a place like Bosnia at its worst time or Chechnya at its worst time. And as a people, we will suffer together if you actively support that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So husbands and wives are experiencing a shared karmic maturation. And it's often the case that if one dies, then the other will die within a fairly... I don't know the statistic, but I think if you checked it out, even the karma for life seems to be intimately connected. And often when one dies, then the other will die within some close amount of time. And I've heard lamas describe that. Okay, we'll do prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hot. The sutra says if you have enough virtue, the shadows will turn from their natural position to cover you. Could wait a long time, I guess. The next part of the Dhammakaya Sutra is very cool. The Buddha says to Subhuti, Subhuti, if any bodhisattva came up to you and said, and you asked the bodhisattva, what are you up to? And the bodhisattva says, I'm working to achieve my Buddha paradise. I'm trying to prepare my Buddha paradise so I'll have some place to go when I get there. He says, if somebody said that to you, he would be a liar. Okay. He says, that Dhamma Mala, says he wouldn't be speaking the truth. Right. What he means is, of course, what? Yeah, if any bodhisattva came up and said to you, I'm working on my paradise, and if that paradise in that bodhisattva's mind was a self-existent paradise, he'd be a liar because you can't get to a self-existent paradise because it's a gotcha. It's a gotcha, right? They don't exist. No such thing exists. If they say, I'm working for a self-existent Buddha paradise, they'd be a liar because there's no such thing. The self-existent thing is non-existent. That's the irony of what causes our suffering. The irony of ignorance is that you are attached to something that don't even exist. It'd be okay if it was something that existed. It'd be a little bit easier to live with, you know. But we are responding to things that don't exist. A self-existent boss who screams at me externally to my own projection doesn't exist. And so my screaming back is predicated on believing in something that doesn't even exist. That's the hard part. I mean, that's the part that hurts the most, you know. I'm reacting to something that doesn't even exist. Then the Buddha says, Buddha paradises don't exist. He says, that person would be a liar because Buddha paradises don't exist. The paradise of a Buddha does not exist. What's the punchline? Self-existently, right? But he doesn't say that. So, of course, this sutra has been interpreted all kinds of wild ways throughout history, and you can read many books, even books about this sutra, that interpret it in a quite unusual way, because that's a hard thing to understand. And then he says, because they don't exist, we can call them Buddha paradise. Which fits in perfect with this thing about imputation, you know. Because they don't exist independently of our imputations or projections, therefore we can call them Buddha paradises. If they existed any other way, we couldn't call them Buddha paradises. And what he's trying to say is, okay, they do exist. Of course they exist, but they exist in name only. They exist by imputation. They exist by your mind projecting onto certain parts or certain data a thing called Buddha paradise, and then calling it Buddha paradise. Is that something that you can do right now voluntarily, at will? No, it's forced on you by your past karma, by your past deeds. I thought you might be interested in a scenario. We got up to where? Where did we last leave our bodhisattva? Eighth level, okay? Eighth level. Got rid of your mental afflictions, got rid of their seeds. Only extremely subtle kinds of energies left for ignorance. Still have to reach the point where you can see all existing objects. Something's got to go on between level 8 and level 10. Okay, something's got to go on between level 8 and reaching full enlightenment. And at this point, the scriptures stumble. Okay? And all these Buddhist scholars in Tibet are trying to figure out exactly what happens during the last few moments, you know. And pretty much they're in agreement that this is like so far beyond us that it's very hard for a human being who's not close to that to figure out exactly what's going on. So I'm going to give you a presentation from one of the Prajnaparamita scriptures. This is as detailed as it gets, and it's a little like reading a science fiction story, okay? And you know, maybe it won't click or anything, and I'm just going to put it up here, and then you do the best you can with it, okay? This is from the scriptures. The process seems a little like science fiction, but it's almost impossible for us to imagine what it's like. So, 8 steps mentioned in that sutra, okay? 8 steps mentioned in this Prajnaparamita text. Apparently you're in some kind of pre-paradise called Ogmen, okay? Like you're very, very close to a total Buddha paradise, but you are in a paradise called Ogmen. This is the result of incredible amounts of virtue. You have been practicing the 6 perfections, and the result of that is called Shingdak Joro, which means the purification of your own Buddha field, your own Buddha paradise. So you're very close, and you're in a place called Ogmen. And it's the same for everybody. You will be in a place called your own Ogmen, I'll be in my Ogmen, okay, like that. By the way, this is emptiness, okay? Yeah, you are in the direct perception of emptiness. It's called Pachimelam. And it's called, say, Gyunte. What's it called here? Gyunte Pachimelam. Gyunte Pachimelam. Pachimelam means the direct perception of emptiness. Gyunta means, Gyun means the stream of your samsaric existence, and Ta means the final moment. Okay, so you are what we call a bodhisattva in the final moment of samsaric existence. Okay. That triggers 6 events. The next 6 events all happen at the same time. Okay. Can I? No, 10th. 10th. Yeah, we're talking just before you enter enlightenment. It's a good point. Let's say he's not in Buddhahood yet, so I don't know where he is. We'll call it samsaric existence. I mean, technically, there's a big debate about it. I mean, is he out of suffering yet? Hard to say. But they do say sukha karma. Let's say samsara. Okay. The next 6 things all happen at once. In general, you can divide all existing objects into the sum total of all existing objects and the real nature of all existing objects. This refers to number 1. So this being this is the first moment of enlightenment. This being is now perceiving directly every object that exists in the universe, either past, present, or future. Okay? You reach the final end. Final end here is called Yandakta. It's a big subject in Prajnaparamita. And it's a code name for the end of aging and death. Okay. This is the end of aging and death. Yeah. These 2 are happening before enlightenment, okay? And the next 6 are during the first moment of enlightenment. There's a big debate about it, but you can call it going from 9 to 10 or something like that. Sometimes 10 to enlightenment, but... well, there are 10 bhumis total, and we're describing how you enter the 10th bhumi, which is enlightenment. Roughly. There's a big debate about it. But some people say 10, and then after that there's something else. But and that's enlightenment. Some people say 10 is enlightenment. I think it gets fuzzy, because you have to be there to know, I guess. They can't say grow or generate or develop the Dhammakaya, because the Dhammakaya is unchanging. And can't go through a process of being smaller and getting bigger and then being complete like a dolt or something. It's just there. It's either there or it's not there. It passes from not being into being, but it doesn't go through a growth process or something like that. So it just comes into existence. Okay? It comes into existence at that moment. You have the Dharmakaya. Now, how does this differ from number three? I'm not completely sure. But it would now include the true nature of all objects, as opposed to just the total quantity of all objects. And what this refers to is the ability of a Buddha, which is unique to a Buddha, to see normal objects and see emptiness directly at the same time. Only a Buddha can do it. How they do it, I mean, when you get in the debate ground, we were talking about it the other day, and you start to discuss perception of something, the first thing you always say is, Sangye Mayimba Shishat, which means, let's not talk about Buddhas, okay? like, how do they do what they do? Very difficult. Very difficult to explain. The literal meaning of the word is below none. Below none. Og means below and min means none. So it means highest. There's two ogmins. One is a level of in samsara. There's a samsaric level of existence called ogmin. And then there's a paradise called ogmin. So you might see them used in different ways, and you have to be careful. This is talking about the Buddha bear that's called ogmin. Okay. The point here is that the body of that bodhisattva at the last moment of samsaric existence provides the raw material. It's that Nyerlingi Gyu that we talked about last night. It's the stuff which turns into the enjoyment body. It swaps over into the enjoyment body. Okay.
Yeah. So you can just know Nyerlingi
Gyu to the Dharma. It is. You can't say Gyu though, please. No, you can't say cause. It doesn't have a cause. Okay.
I thought it
was a little tricky. The basis changes and that emptiness is, it's still the emptiness of your mind. That's true. But now your mind, if you want to get technical, has two extraordinary qualities. One is the emptiness that it always had. But now it is empty in another way as well. And that is that it is totally devoid of all obscurations, all obstacles. So in that case, the emptiness of the Buddha's mind is slightly different from the emptiness of your mind. Although, the thing which becomes the emptiness of the Buddha's mind you have now, and that is your Sugatigarbha. Okay. Go back to the glass of water. Okay, there's a glass of water sitting... I'm sorry. Big boo-boo. Very, what do they call that? Parochial statement. Glass of liquid. Okay. There's a glass of liquid on the table. There's a preta, a human, and a worldly pleasure being sitting around it. And they all see a different thing. One of them sees water, one of them sees a glass of blood and pus, and one of them sees a glass of nectar of the god. Okay. And every object in the world is the same. And at this point in the sutra, the Buddha says, you know, I'm not just talking about Buddha paradises. I'm talking about every object in the world. It's true of every object in the world that they don't exist, and because they don't exist, we can call them what they are. So really, if you... Now let's posit a fourth person sitting around the table. And that's a Buddha. Okay, and you've reached level number 10. You made it. You're sitting around the table. You're looking at the water. Liquid. Real human bias. And what do you see? Well, you're aware of how other beings see them. You know, I mean, do you experience samsara as a Buddha? I mean, I had the honor of being the first debater on the day that Pabongka Rinpoche, the new one, took his Geshe exam. Because at the time I was the oldest non-Geshe in our college, and he's in our college. So I had the honor of making the first debate. And I said, do Buddhas experience samsara? And then he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, is he aware of what the other three people are seeing? Because what they're seeing is samsara. That's suffering. So if the Buddha's see what the other beings see, which he has to see if he's going to see everything, then isn't he experiencing samsara? You know, and that, is he aware of their pain, and doesn't that make him sad, and isn't that a kind of suffering? It was like a 2-hour back and forth, and you have to think about it. But basically, you can say, I believe they say it in this way, samsaric objects can present them, they can be aware that you are perceiving these objects as samsara. But they don't experience them as samsara. They're aware that that's how you see them, but they can't see them that way, themselves. So that you're sitting around, and you're a Buddha, and you're sitting at this table in this special bar, and you're seeing a glass full of total bliss. It's total bliss. The experience for a Buddha is that every part of every object that they perceive is creating total bliss in them. Okay. So it would be as if, I mean, I like to say, think of the most pleasant experience you ever had in your life. I mean, everyone has two or three that they cherish, you know. But I don't care if it's physical or mental or whatever. But imagine the moment of your life that you had the most extreme and intense pleasure. You know, maybe it lasted for 5 minutes or something. And then imagine that every single object in your life could trigger the same emotion in you all the time. I mean, that's how you have to think of a Buddha field. So like the flowers there and the leaves on the trees are provoking this intense bliss in them all the time. And every single existing object, the squareness of the paper, the whiteness, the thinness, the sharpness, the smoothness, every detail of every object is producing total bliss in that being. Okay, how could that happen? Okay, we have to talk about how could that happen. Very dear to our heart subject, you know. It would be nice. the first question and the obvious. Now it becomes very simple to answer these deep questions. Is there two glasses of liquid on the table, or? I mean, are there four glasses or just one? It's just one, okay? If you don't go deeper, is there... That's the right answer if I don't say if you don't go deeper. There's only one glass of water there. So now I ask you... Liquid, sorry. Where is this paradise? And I mean specifically, do you have to go somewhere else? I mean, now the answer becomes obvious. You know, it's not like you have to ask the waitress to bring another glass of liquid. Okay? You're dealing with the data which is already present. That's one interesting point. Okay. In other words, Buddha paradise is not like 3 miles up there or 4 miles that way or something like that. The data for your paradise is around you now. It is your world. You don't need to go somewhere else to find the raw material. You just can't synthesize it in the right way right now because you're not being forced to by any ultimate karma, you know, by all these collections of karma. The data is there. You could be experiencing this world in a completely different way. It's just your mind is not cooking up the right interpretation of that data. Okay, it's not synthesizing it in an ultimate way, because it can't, because you don't have the karmas to do it. The karmic seeds are not there to force you to see it that way. And by the way, it sounds very artificial, and it is, but that's what makes it real, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. How a Buddha's mind works is very difficult to talk about. But
I've always thought of it as more of a matter of
he is. They are. Okay. And And the manner in which they perceive things is a lot different from how we perceive things. But basically, the same process is still taking place. And the proof of that is that you do have to collect karma for that long. We don't call it karma anymore. By the way, I'm using the word karma about Buddhahood creating deeds. It's called the two collections, which is in your prayer at the end of the class every day. You say those two collections, which basically refers to the six perfections. Okay. We don't call it, technically, we don't call it karma at that point. We call it the two collections. Okay. One more point about that. That pretty much wraps up Buddha Parinasa. Okay. What is the difference between samsara and a Buddha Parinasa? Why is samsara like this? And why is the Buddha paradise so much different? What's the basic difference between the two? What makes them different? Yeah. We call Lei Dan Nyomongi Wongi, okay? Lei Dan Nyomong. The two big troublemakers. There's an idea in Christianity called, what's it called, original sin or something like that. You know, like the world is defective from the start. We have a very similar idea. Samsara, your body, your mind, my body, my mind, everything about me, and the world I live in, is defective from the word go. There's a basic defect. There's a certain energy in our bodies, in our minds, in our world, which screws up everything, and has to and always will. I mean, until you get out. By the way, getting out of samsara now becomes a little tricky, right? We always thought it was like leaving L.A. what's it called? What movie are you going to see tonight? Where's that guy? Where's Ragnar? What'd you pick for tonight? Anyway, it's not like getting out, you know, it's not like you go anywhere. It's not like running away from anywhere. The world we live in, and every experience that we are allowed to have now, that we are capable of, is defective. Because it's running from the engine of these two things. These two things are running it. They're calling the shots. They are producing your world right now. Lei means dirty karma. Okay? Impure karma. Sakchegi lei. And Nyomo means mental afflictions, and you had a nice introduction to them this morning. And they've been close friends for a long time. Okay? So these two are calling the shots. In any world where these two are calling the shots, if they are infecting your world, nothing's going to go right. Ultimately, you'll always have frictions with other people. Your body will be uncooperative. It'll keep getting older and uglier. You'll lose your sight, you lose your hearing, you lose your ability to taste things. You gotta have triple strong coffee before you can taste anything. Can't do the things you used to do, don't have the energy you used to have. And eventually one of those organs misfires and they take you to the hospital. And it has to go like that. Unless you do something now, there will be no other course of action. It must end up like that because it's being generated by karma and klesha, by karma and bad deeds. Okay, it was created. This body, with this kind of body, was created by karma and bad deeds, by dirty karma. Okay, and it can only be that. It can't have any other end, and you can't be happy until you get rid of nyamu. It's impossible. You never will be, no matter how you adjust your life. And we spend our lives adjusting our lives. Maybe if I did a little more yoga, you know, maybe if I ate those other vitamins, you know, maybe if this guy would leave my office, you know, maybe if I just had a little more free time to myself, things would be all right. It's not going to be all right. Didn't you figure that out yet? I mean, you know, didn't it click yet, you know? You gotta be 43 and you still didn't figure that out yet, you know? Try a different partner, you know? yeah. Right, exactly. Exactly. She said, what's dirty karma? I said, good deeds without the knowledge of emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Basically. What does it create? It creates good dinners, which have as the tail of the dog getting hungry again. Okay. Always have. So now, on this basis, their answer that the two people gave was, yeah, this is what's the big difference between a Buddha paradise and samsara. Buddha paradise ain't got these two things running it. These two things are not generating a Buddha paradise. Okay, a Buddha paradise is being maintained. That projection is being maintained and perpetuated like fission, you know, less energy going in, more paradise coming out, by something which is totally free of mental affliction and karma, dirty karma. Okay? It's being generated by different causes. There's no taste of either one of these in what's keeping a Buddha field going. You know, in what's keeping a Buddha paradise up. You know, what's keeping it running is doesn't have any one of these two. Therefore, there's no suffering there. Impossible. And there's a thing in the scripture that says there's a word missing in the vocabulary of those beings. They don't even have it in their dictionaries. And that's suffering. The word for that thing doesn't exist there. Because there's no such thing.
Okay.
Some people say that would be boring. It's not boring. You've got all these emanation bodies to send out to trillions of worlds. You're quite happily busy, okay? It's not like static or nothing going on there. It's a lot of fun. Okay. And all those bodies going out and taking care of billions of people and at the moment when they're ready to have it. Okay. We'll probably take a break. Any questions right there? Or? Yeah, John. Yeah. It's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor.
Yeah, they see how we feel suffering. It makes them somehow... I mean, the answer I got to one of my questions to Pabon Kampuchei was, they're aware of your suffering, but what they feel is compassion. And compassion is not suffering. So they feel bad in the sense that they feel compassion. But that is not that kind of sweet, sad feeling is not suffering for them. It's not a kind of suffering. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Half of it is. Half of it is. She said it's the stuff that the Buddhas are perceiving as bliss, is that the true nature of reality. Well, half of it is emptiness. Half of what they're perceiving is jitta vichara, which means the way all things are, which means pure emptiness. And they are even forced to perceive that as bliss. And then on the other hand, every other object in their life is also raw material to be synthesized into a thing called bliss. Okay, it doesn't mean that they can't see a stupa or something, or the sun, but when they look at it, it instead of creating a yellow consciousness, it creates a yellow consciousness which is also the pure experience of bliss. Okay. Yeah. We're not there yet?
It's wrong.
How?
There's not enough speaking to, in my mind, there's not enough speaking to how great it is to be a human being. What an opportunity. You know, like the whole hit of it is that it's wrong. That's what I believe.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so when are we going to start speaking to the solution?
Oh, right now. You'll be the Buddha. They always do this. If you're having a good class, it's always a guy like that. And this is exactly what you asked, okay? Which is this. Well, basically, how are you going to get it to happen? And it's this. If you are that guy and you're having your fingers and arms cut off, or in the modern world, if your boss is screaming at you for losing out on a big deal for the company, same thing. and you just totally understand the emptiness, and you know that you don't want to perpetuate this thing, so you do not respond with violence. You know, you respond with, at best, with neutral, at best with some kind of compassion. Suppose you start acting like that today. Suppose you can do it perfectly from today. Do you collect any new dirty karma? No, I'm talking total arhat. Never again a bad thought. Never again the slightest trace of a bad thought. Are you creating any more dirty karma? Do you have any karmic pockets? Yeah, now there's a defect in the presentation, okay? Okay, from the time point of view that you're in an arhat on, you're not collecting any new bad karma. But you sure have a lot of old bad karma. How old is it? And I'll ask you this way, is it bad karma you created in this life? Or is it bad karma you created in the life just before that? Or is it bad karma that you created in every life before that? All three. Abhidhamma says, of course, all three. You have all three in your karmic pocket. So now we have a problem. How long is it going to take to reach this Buddha paradise? No problem if you have, no problem if you could shut it all off now. In other words, what I'm saying is that we have to deal with new dirty karma, and we have to deal with big pockets of old dirty karma. Okay? To get to Buddha paradise, it's not enough to see emptiness now and start acting right now. It's not enough. That only deals with the new bad karma. We have to talk about how to get rid of old bad karma. According to the Hinayana, according to the lower school, you cannot wear off that old bad karma. You can't accelerate it, you must experience it. There's no getting out of bad karma. You must go through all the bad experiences from the karma that you have stored up. You have to wait until it wears off. It could take many, many millions of years. Okay? You have to wait until it all wears off. That's the Hinayana position. Mahayana says something totally different. Mahayana says there is a method by which you can accelerate that karma or even short-circuit it. It's like, I always tell people it's like this movie I saw with John Travolta. It's about an item bomb. What was that? Broken Arrow, yeah. And the whole movie is about atomic bombs about to go off and smart people turning them off at the last minute, you know? Like, here's this huge potential called an atomic bomb. And all these guys, good guys and bad guys, are always, you know, as the counter goes down on the readout, and you're sitting at the edge of your seat, you know, they always, Christian Slater, what's his name? No. You have to see me. he's always able to tinker with it at the last minute. He's got guts. He doesn't run. No place to run anyway. And he's tinkering with it, and he's always, at the last 3 seconds, you know, he's always pulling out the right wire and it stops and the thing doesn't go off. That's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about how do you manipulate, how do you short circuit your old karma. You know, it's of great interest to people who have already learned how to not create new bad karma, which is where you're at now. You already know the trick to not creating new dirty karma. Now you just have to figure out how to short circuit the old bad karma, and you could reach paradise in this very life, in this existence. The glass of liquid could turn into a total bliss without going anywhere. And we just have to learn how to do that. Yeah. Nope. Okay, so we're going to take a break. And when you get back, we'll talk about it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. She said, suppose you're emanating as a Dalai Lama. Suppose the Dalai Lama is one of your emanation bodies that you're sending out. Then are you aware of the pain of getting old, getting bald, getting wrinkly, getting stooped over, losing your energy? Are you aware of that? The answer is, do you think he's experiencing his life that way? No. I mean, we don't know for sure. If you're an honest Buddhist, you know, if you're a logical Buddhist, you have to say, look, I don't know for sure. I don't know who he really is. I cannot vouch for who he is really. But based on the evidence I have that I can vouch for, and based on my knowledge of what enlightenment is like, and based on my knowledge of the glass of liquid in the bar, it's totally plausible and could very well be happening that he ain't experiencing his body at all the way you and me are experiencing it.
Okay.
And that makes sense. You know, if my mind is not purified yet, I could be seeing, I could have the incredible good karma to have a Dalai Lama in the world. By the way, everyone who ever meets him, everyone who ever hears about him, and you could throw in Lama Sopa, Lama Usel, Lama Yeshe IV, if you have the experience to even hear about them or see them or hear something they said, and if they are walking on this planet, you already have an extraordinary amount of virtue. You know, like everybody on the planet, we talked about communal karma this morning. Everybody on this planet in 1996 has the communal karma to see the Dalai Lama walking around on the planet. And that's an incredibly powerful virtue. That virtue is wearing out.
Okay.
That virtue is wearing out. And as it wears out, you will see him get older and older.
Okay.
And when it reaches a certain point of weakness, that karma, you will see that Dalai Lama pass from this planet.
Okay.
And it, what he sees is totally, he's up in Dharmakaya, no problem for him if he's a Buddha. And you have to say if, you know. And he probably is from all I can see. But if you see this person getting old and passing from this planet, that's your good karma wearing out. In other words, you can't ride on good karma forever. You must take advantage of it while you got it. That's what they talk about a precious human rebirth. You know, your good karma, every moment that you're in this body and every moment that you're in a class and every moment that you're reading a scripture or being a Buddhist, you're wearing out good karma. And it will end. And if you don't do what you have to do before it wears out, you're out of luck. You know, to get this kind of karma back again is almost impossible. I mean, the scriptures say never again. And then they say, okay, one in a trillion, you know. But, lentignia gadoe dentro di, you know. Lentignia means only one time that you can get this kind of circumstances. And it's wearing out. Your Dalai Lama karma is wearing out. Your body karma is wearing out. Your Buddhism class karma is wearing out. And you will lose these beings. And then you'll be back to zero. You literally go back to zero. Okay. Two questions, and we'll... By the way, you don't have to wait till the end. Mm-hmm. It could be next year. Okay. Yeah. Oh, no, it does carry over. Absolutely, it carries over. I mean, any moment that you could pick up a Dharma book instead of picking up a newspaper, it's no waste of time. It's all, it's an ecology. Nothing is lost. I had a great lama, a Mongolian lama, and he just as he was passing away, he was reading elementary logic, you know. And I said, Geshe-la, you know, you're dying. And why are you reading the kindergarten book for the monastery? He said, gotta get ready. You know. You know, nothing is lost, nothing is wasted. The slightest Dharma thing you can do is saved and stored and worth it, you know. One more question here. Oh, absolutely. But when you teach Dharma, you're supposed to be very pessimistic, so people will get off their rear ends and do something, you know. But by being, yeah, absolutely. But to collect the amount that got you here is almost impossible. The odds are, they describe in the scripture something like 999 to 1 that you won't be able to pull it off. That you won't be able to pull off collecting as much good karma as created your present circumstances for the future. So you must do it now. You have to do it now.
Huh? That's it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, take a break. And the Diamond Sutra says that the next thing it says is that any place where this sutra is taught carefully, and people are listening to it seriously, then that place becomes holy ground. And that physical location becomes holy ground. So that's the good news. There's holy ground here now. Okay, where you have sat will always be holy ground now. So that's very cool, I think. Now to the bad news. The Buddha says, right after that, he says, by the way, all the people who were in that place when that sutra was taught, because of the teaching of that sutra, will now experience extreme suffering. Okay? He says, anyone who was in that class, anyone who understood what was going on, they can expect some disasters in their life. Okay? Like real suffering. And that's because the study of emptiness accelerates your bad karma. We're talking about your old pockets of bad karma. Your pockets of old bad karma. You know, what are you going to do with these old karmas? Is there any way you can defuse them or get them to go off sooner in a lesser way or something like that? And the Mahayana says, absolutely yes. Okay? And it's intimately connected with the study of emptiness. And when I heard it was a Hinayana Mahayana thing, I thought, oh, this is probably something that the Tibetan Lamas made up or something like that. You know, this thing about short-circuiting karma or wearing off karma, it's probably some later addition to the scriptures by somebody who was trying to be optimistic or something. I mean, Tibetan Buddhism is often, you know, people say, oh, that's just those Lamas made that up, you know. Or, that's just those Lamas trying to be a little more optimistic, you know. The process of short-circuiting your karma, the process of purifying your old bad karma, first of all, it's obviously taught in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and you can read it, and it's there, and you don't have to take my word for it, you have it in your reading today, okay? The Buddha directly says, anyone who studies this subject deeply will suffer, because their old bad karma will accelerate, and it will ripen faster. So what's the use? I mean, maybe it'd be better to stretch it out a little, so you can, it's like, would you rather have one big root canal or four cavities, you know? It'd be better to stretch it out a little bit. Then the sutra says, but the second point is that it comes back in an infinitely lesser form. Okay? That when you accelerate it by the study of emptiness, and the karma comes back to you, it ripens on you quickly, it's infinitely less than it would have been if you hadn't studied the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And the example in the Diamond Cutter, Chöni Lama quotes another sutra, is that if you had a karma in your karmic pocket that was supposed to lead you to a rebirth in the house, and if you studied this subject carefully and do the proper purification, which has four steps and we'll talk about it, that karma which was going to lead you to hell will ripen as a headache in this life. Okay. You know, you're accelerating the karma, and the karma is coming back much, much less intense. So to learn that trick would be very important. We better get to it fast in case somebody dies. These are called, let's see. Oh, good luck. Say, Topshi. Topshi. Learn it well. Okay? Learn it now, learn it well. And then use it. I mean, there's two steps here. You have to learn it, and then you have to use it. Not many people ever learn it. Almost nobody uses it. Topshi. Top means force or power. Force. Top means force. Like energy. Strong energy. Force. Shi means four. So there are four steps to this process. Four steps to getting a hell birth to turn into a headache. All right, of great interest to us. All right, not only from day to day. I mean, they would make you much happier immediately, but also in the process of getting to your Buddha paradise. You know, you use your knowledge of emptiness to prevent new dirty karma, and then you wipe out your old dirty karma with these four powers. And then you ain't got no dirty karma left, and you don't see a glass of water anymore. You see a glass of bliss. okay? All right, number one. Thank you, Top. Thank you, Top. This is called the basis force. Okay, the force of the basis. Basis force. By the way, the answer key here is messed up, okay? It says basis force for all four, okay? Okay? Just so you know, if you're grading paper. Okay, this is the basis force. And the idea is this. When you fall down, you have to have some solid ground below you to get back up. When you fall down, you have to have, if the ground was like jello, you couldn't get back up. The ground has to be, there has to be a firm foundation for you to get back up. The idea here is that you go back to the basics of Buddhism. And there's two parts here. One is, you go back to taking refuge. You review what it means to take refuge. We had a taste of it the other day. You take refuge in, what are two of the refuges? Two of the refuge objects are what? It's Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, right? Dharma and Sangha are covered once you see emptiness directly. You become the objects of refuge. You are two of the three jewels the day that you see emptiness directly. When Buddhists all over the world take refuge in the three jewels, hey, you're two of them. They're taking refuge in you. Okay? Because Sangha jewel, not Sangha, but Sangha jewel, is anyone who's seen emptiness directly. Their state of mind is the Dharma jewel. It's jewel number two. So you've got it, two and three are covered already. The Buddha jewel you don't have yet because you didn't go through all those other levels. But the main Buddha jewel is the Dharmakaya, and you saw the Dharmakaya. You were in the presence of the Dharmakaya because you saw emptiness. Okay. So you pretty much got like two and a half jewels covered just by being yourself at that point. Okay. So you're taking refuge in those three objects. Go back to taking refuge. You are not taking refuge in some statue. You are not taking refuge in some book. Okay? Maybe in the contents of the book, but I mean, don't think of Dharma as a book. Don't think of the Buddha as some painting or some statue of a guy with a funny head or something like that. It's not the point. The main refuge is the knowledge of emptiness. Okay? So you go back to taking refuge. You go back to taking refuge. Why does it protect you? Why does that refuge protect you? If you understand emptiness, you are not going to retaliate. If you don't retaliate, you don't collect new bad karma. That's protection. That's refuge. That's the only refuge. That's the main refuge, okay? That's the first half of the Tengyutob. Second half of Tengyutob is go back to Bodhicitta. You know, go back and review what it is to have a deep compassion or a deep concern for other people's problems. Okay. Go back to that. Go back to those two basics, which is what Sangye Chodan Soke Chonama is all. That is the practice. That is it. Go back to those two. Review those two. That's Tengyutob. You get back up from that. Did you have a question? No. Okay. What is the second top? Same number? Sunjinbe, stop. Number? Sunjinbe, stop. Number Sunjinbe means to rip something out. This is the force of destruction. The force of destruction. Okay. Number Sunjinbe means to tear something out from the roots. Okay. Translated as the destruction force. And at this point, most of the lamas give this cool explanation. They say, three guys are sitting at a bar. This keeps coming up, right? Haven't really been to one lately, but three guys are sitting at a bar, and the bartender puts out three shot glasses, and he says, "What do you have?" And they all say whiskey. So he takes this bottle of brown liquid down from the shelf. He's like digging through the shelf. He grabs a bottle, and he pours out the three shot glasses from the same bottle. And these guys are joking around, and they're all sitting there, and they all grab the shot glasses, and they click glasses, and they all down it in one gulp, you know. In Tibetan, they call hoop-cheek-hoop, you know. And then after about 3 seconds, the guy on the first stool starts to go into convulsions, you know. And he falls over, dead. And the bartender's like, oh my God, I gave you that nitric acid I had on the shelf, you know. And then the second guy is like, and he falls over dead, you know. And then the third guy is watching the first two guys, you know. And that emotion, right after the second guy falls off the bar stool, is Sunjin Beto. Sunjin Beto means, it's called intelligent regret. It means, okay, it means that I shouldn't have drunk that, you know. It's the regret of an educated Buddhist, okay. It's the regret of an educated Buddhist. If we have time someday, you have to study Abhidharma 4th chapter, which is how is karma planted in your mind. When you commit a karma, how is the seed planted in your mind? Unfortunately, the main requirement is that you be present when the karma is committed. The perception of yourself doing it plants it. And unfortunately, you're always present. So it's primarily the perception of yourself doing it which plants it. What it means is karma is absolutely unforgiving. Okay. If you do a bad deed, and you're there when it's done, it's planted. That means it's no good, you know, locking the door of your room and doing it in the privacy of your own room, you know, because someone's still there, and that's you. So as far as non-virtues or bad karmas, it doesn't matter who knows or who doesn't know. It doesn't matter where it's done. It doesn't matter how sneaky you do it. It's still recorded. It's unforgiving. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, like in the Vinaya, they discuss the idea of temporary insanity.
Okay.
Like if a monk actually goes crazy for some reason or another, usually it's grief. Okay. Someone close to him dies, and if under those conditions he does something, you know, while he's crazy and he's not even aware of exactly what he's doing or something like that, there's almost, but he does not break his vow.